You're listening to Practically Ideal.
You gotta be practically ideal instead of just ideal.
Ready for some podcasting.
Oh, Logan, you got any better, man?
All work and no play.
Live! This is Practically Culture, a podcast devoted to TV, movies, and other pop culture. I'm your host, Logan Bo, podcasting from Brooklyn. I'm joined by the one, the only Bob Caswell in the Bay Area. How are you, Bob?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, hanging out. You know me.
Nice.
Welcome to the new and improved podcast. We've got Blue Jasmine, some mini reviews, and our weekend entertainment picks. Also, TV recaps of The Newsroom, The Bridge, and Ray Donovan. It's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. Let's rock. Oh, man, it is good to be back, Bob. You look great as we videocast this live on a Google Plus Hangout on air.
Thank you. You're looking great yourself with your glasses.
That's right, glasses. My educated lumberjack look today for all those joining us.
Love it.
Ready to get to it?
Yeah, let's do this.
Let's talk Blue Jasmine, Bob. A life crisis causes a woman to head to San Francisco, where she reconnects with her sister. Is the synopsis really all that relevant in a Woody Allen movie?
Barely.
but yeah, written and directed by Woody Allen, starring Cate Blanchett, Alex Baldwin, Sally Hawkins, and plenty of fun smaller roles. Bob, do you have a mini review for us?
Yeah, let me tell you what I thought. Let's pull it up here. So I gave Blue Jasmine a 4 out of 5, and this is what I say about it. Cate Blanchett and the ensemble cast really bring to life this Woody Allen life crisis, in quotes, life crisis dramedy. I enjoyed the story, characters, and economic disparity theme, mixed feelings on the ending, and a couple of forced plot drivers. So there you have it. I'm hedging a little. I really liked it a lot, actually, but a couple of annoying points. I'm giving it a 4 out of 5.
Right on. Here's my mini review. Every character and scene crackles with neurotic energy, giving us plenty of great moments. I was initially impressed by the constant anxiety it provoked, but ultimately didn't get enough payoff to make that anxiety completely worth it. 3 out of 5.
Wow. Wow, you dipped down into the lower spectrum of the I'm okay but still have issues with this movie.
Well, yeah, some movies, Bob, you know, you sense they're trying to tell you something, but you don't completely get it. It just doesn't land for you, no matter how much you can really appreciate the well-executed components. Blue Jasmine was totally that way for me.
Really? Okay, so let's talk about it. So tell me what didn't fit together, or what was it about the anxiety-prone, anxiety-inducing features that rubbed you the wrong way?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that stood out for me from what I've said already, because I really noticed that. More than anything, just Cate Blanchett's Jasmine, her anxiety, it just was contagious. It came right through the screen, and all I wanted to do was take a Xanax myself the whole time.
Along with her.
Yeah, right. Hey, give me one of those, Jasmine. For example, a great scene right towards the beginning. You know, she's at her sister Ginger's house. She's come to live there because she used to be fabulously wealthy with her husband Hal, played by Alec Baldwin, but it's all gone now, all of it. And so here she is in Ginger's place explaining how absolutely destitute she is. She's got nothing. She's popping pills, drinking Stoli, and she lets slip that she flew first class. This broke woman, she flies first class, and Ginger's like, excuse me? You flew first class? I thought you were broke. And Jasmine, completely unaware of the irony, she's like, of course I did. And that scene just sets up the tone of the movie very terrifically.
But that's exactly what I love about it. I don't see a negative there. Actually, I loved whenever the movie showed Jasmine in full force not knowing how to deal with her economic situation. Like, even in that same scene, she has to tip her cab driver who has to wait around for her sister to come home. And she obviously gives him a huge tip because he's like, oh, thank you. So
yeah,
she has,
right.
Like, some, yeah, she has, like, some lingering leftovers from her past life that she's burning through really fast and she doesn't even realize it. And then later in the movie you see another scene where she's talking with her sister's kids, which is actually a hilarious scene because she's treating them like adults, and she brings up the whole, like, now you need to tip good in life. You have to really tip well in life because you never know how that's going to come back to you. Or she had some, like, burning advice to share with them, which made no sense in her current situation. I just love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I love that scene because it tells us so much about the characters and their relationship to each other. And I like it. I'm impressed when a movie can make me feel something so much. Like, this made me feel anxiety. It's just that as it went on, I kept feeling the anxiety, but then I felt like I didn't get as much of a payoff in terms of story or resolution or what's the point here as I would like.
Now, for me, that has more to do with the ending than the play-by-play. Because I thought the play-by-play was... The payoff was just to show how different people in different levels of society interacting with each other, even if they're forced to change, they really can't change. And I don't mean to, like, review the movie so on the nose here, like... There's some subtleties to how these characters are portrayed, but it's basically white collar versus blue collar, and watching the hilarity that ensues when the two have to interact in a way that otherwise doesn't usually happen in life. The really rich stay away from the barely making it generally, but in this case, when it's family and when one of them has a bit of a breakdown or at least loses all their money, I thought it was played out pretty realistically, and I feel like we all have a little bit of this in life. Of course, on the screen it's a little exaggerated, but just to see it played out in full force, that dynamic of those two extremes, blue collar versus white collar, I don't know, it really worked for me, anxiety-inducing tendencies aside, I guess.
Yeah, well, I feel like you're really trying to sell me on this movie, and I just want to say that I'm not trying to come across as too antagonistic. I'm coming from maybe liked parts of it and other parts I didn't quite get. The anxiety is sort of a mixed bag for me. Like I said, I'm impressed with it. I'm not criticizing it for that necessarily, but that was the most prominent feature for me. Anxiety invoked in me, but I think you're right on with what you say about the differences in class here. I also think apparently there were tons of references to Streetcar Named Desire, which I have to admit sheepishly never having seen. And I wonder if that would have helped make it click more for me.
I wonder. I didn't realize that either, actually. I might have seen that movie, or at least part of it, like for a film class or something, but honestly, sometimes the great ones, I have to pretend like, oh, right, Citizen Kane, this is amazing, okay.
Right, let's talk about something else quick.
Exactly.
We do have to talk about, Cate Blanchett and Alec Baldwin. Both were wonderful in their roles, I thought.
Absolutely.
Because Jasmine really was kind of a bitch, but instead of hating her, we mostly felt sorry for her and sympathized with her, I thought.
Yeah, because for being a bitch, she was put into situations like with her dentist, her employer. So I should set the context. She, first on her list of things to do when after losing all her money and spending it on first-class plane tickets to go live with her sister, is try to find a job, and she ends up, through her sister's boyfriend, getting hooked up with a potential opportunity as like a office admin at a dentist's office. But then the dentist has some issues and sort of comes on to her, and without giving up too much of it, you just feel bad for her because she gets a break, and in her new blue-collar life, things are starting to work out, but then they don't work out. But then it's a lot her fault.
Yes.
But somehow you feel bad for her because you empathize with the moments that are less about her fault, and the ones that are her fault feel like they're not as... big a deal by comparison for some reason.
Yeah, and walking that line, I think, is squarely, the credit goes to Cate Blanchett. I think she's terrific in the way she pulls that off.
Yeah, I agree. And even Alec Baldwin for being... Now, we only see Alec Baldwin in flashbacks, which is kind of... I just have to give my disclaimer here. Normally, I hate flashbacks, but actually, I thought this movie handled the flashback really, really well. So it was kind of telling two concurrent stories.
Yeah, two parallel stories like that. I thought it was okay.
Yeah, me too. And Alec Baldwin was only in the past one, and he was the husband who had all the money, and we sort of see the decline. But mostly it's shown to show the positive side. We don't get too much of the decline till closer to the end in that story. But he did a really good job of being a really rich guy that you can't just hate automatically. He seemed like a pretty normal guy for being rich, right?
Rich equals hate automatically, almost, or danger of that.
Well, in the movie anyway, when they're making a point about the 1% or whatever, but yeah.
Well, I was impressed that I wasn't thinking about Jack Donaghy the whole time. And, you know, it's not that I don't think Alec Baldwin can't play a different role, but the characters are sort of vaguely similar, but he managed to tease out a lot of distinction, and it was just a different guy.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. He was very Alec Baldwin-y, but different enough that I didn't have that issue of confusing him with his 30 Rock role.
Right. And there were a lot of fun small roles. Andrew Dice Clay was great, Ginger's ex-husband, who pops in from time to time to remind us that Hal really messed up his life and a lot of other people's lives.
Yes. Now, we'll come back to him because there's one scene with him that bugged me, but yes.
Oh, I want to hear it now.
Okay. So this has less to do with him as an actor and more to do with Woody Allen's writing. So this is going to be my, like, annoyed segment, I guess, of why I dinged the movie a bit. But, like, Woody Allen has a couple of lazy moments where characters come on screen to kind of move the plot along, and there's one involving Andrew Dice Clay's character where he just randomly out of the blue bumps into Jasmine in the street, and without getting into the details, he ends up ruining the moment for her and saying a lot more than he should, and it was just so coincidental and a little over the top for me. It didn't come across as believable. And there's just, since I'm on this theme, I just have to point out one other scene where you see how characters doing things behind each other's back is kind of comes to life. And it's, again, like, this is on location in New York City, and there's another coincidence, like, oh, in the city, the two of us just happen to see each other randomly,
sure.
You know. And Woody Allen has done this in other movies, and maybe it's forgivable, and I'm spending way too much time on it, but it bugs me when there are better ways for people to interact with each other or to find out about their secrets than just like a random I see you across the street sort of thing, because that feels very lazy to me.
That's fair enough. That is fair enough. The thing about Woody Allen that I noticed in not a good way was at times, and this probably happens in all Woody Allen movies, but I just kept imagining, oh, that's something Woody Allen would say. So I just, like, all these characters, little Woody Allens talking to each other and having fights with each other or conversations. Just everyone seemed like Woody Allen at some point to me.
Yeah, there's a bit of that, too.
Another fun small role, Louis C.K., a regular dude that Ginger has a fling with.
Yeah, I dig Louis C.K. Actually, I think he's perfect for these types of small roles. I wish he were in more movies like this, because he brings some color to the film in a way that only he can. I love it.
Yeah, now Louis C.K. isn't necessarily the broadest, rangiest actor out there, but he's cultivated this one kind of guy, and he does a really great job with that. And he was
exactly.
That same kind of guy, and it was perfect here.
Agreed.
Bobby Cannavale, Ginger's current man. You know, I didn't realize just how many of Ginger's lovers we have in this movie, but Cannavale is her current neurotic but somehow also sweet man. And all those guys just bring a lot of flavor to the movie, which helped a lot.
Yeah, charming performance by Bobby Cannavale. I really like him from a lot of other movies, like The Station Agent is one of my favorite movies where I first saw him. and he does a good job as the, like, grease monkey, blue collar, you know, beer drinking, fight watching, simpleton but charming guy that's kind of a caricature of blue collar malehood, or I don't know what to call it, but I like
the
way
he plays
it. Yeah,
but not too dangerous. He never seemed like he was really going to put anyone in danger or do anything really destructive. All bark and no bite, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the most he does is, like, knock over a lamp when he's pissed, which is funny.
But yeah, Bob, I just had a hard time really grasping the through line, the journey Jasmine did or didn't go through, the moral, anything like that. Maybe it's just me. And, you know, the anxiety that came right out of Blanchett's Jasmine started to get uncomfortable to me after a while. You know, I'm impressed with the ability of the movie to do that. I just want to say that one more time. But to tell the truth, I was left a little wanting by the end.
Okay, well, we don't have to dissect it too much, even though I actually loved the moral of the story, or whatever you want to call it. I thought it was fascinating. My issue had more to do with the quirky, well, with the lazy writing in a couple scenes, which I already talked about, and then the ending without you know, this is spoiler free, but it doesn't, let's just say you don't get much closure. This is kind of a slice of life movie, and it's picking its slice of life very deliberately. So you see the sort of the high times and the low times, but then in the end, I think it's the ending that sort of leaves you wanting, not knowing where you were supposed to go with this and what you were supposed to take from it, other than just like, oh, that was an interesting slice of life. But the actual journey I really, really enjoyed, and so that's why I think I liked it a bit more than you.
Yeah, I guess so. I liked it 3 out of 5. You liked it 4 out of 5. I think if you like Woody Allen movies usually, you'll probably like this one. Yeah, that's about it for me.
Yeah, or any of those actors, they all do great jobs doing their quirky performances. So if you like 2 or 3 out of these actors we just listed, that's probably good enough reason. But if you're apprehensive about seeing anxiety on screen, among other things, yeah, who knows? This is kind of a mixed bag from us, I guess.
Yeah, and there we go, I guess. Blue Jasmine.
Go see it.
All right, Bob, I've got a mini review for us today. Orange is the New Black. We started the show together a few weeks back, right?
Yeah, if you can say that, I guess that as much as together as you can start a Netflix show, but definitely I gave it a few episodes before giving up, and it sounds like you finished it.
Giving up? I was wondering how far you pushed forward, but you put it on the official giving up pile, huh?
Well, let's just say it's on the pretty far on the back burner. Like, maybe I shouldn't be so definitive. Like, it could come back, but it's pretty far down the queue by comparison. There's just a lot of other TV that, you know, has my interest at this moment.
Sure. So let me get to my actual mini review here. Orange is the New Black. It might seem slow, but I liked it more and more as I got deeper into the world it creates. The yuppie protagonist is maybe the least likable character in the rich, vivid community of prisoners. 4 out of 5. Stars, of course, Taylor Schilling as Piper Chapman, and it's created by Jenji Kohan of Weeds fame. So this is one of the new Netflix model shows,
mm-hmm.
where they just release it all at once. And I gotta say that this is probably my favorite of all the shows that Netflix has released in its original programming blitz this year.
Wow, that is a huge statement. I guess I'll let you finish.
So it's not very plot based. You know, I mean, this is a mini review. I'm not going to get tons into it, but this yuppie woman, she ends up going to jail for something she did years ago. It finally caught up with her, and she's in this sort of medium security prison with a lot of people who are not very much like her, not too many yuppies in jail, I guess. And so she has to learn to survive, to fit in, to make her way into place, and she has relationships with her fiancé outside of the prison that has its ups and downs. Yeah, it's one of those. I feel like we've got a wave recently of not so likable female protagonists, and I don't know if people are trying to make a statement here, but I feel like it's interesting to notice. Like Enlightened was this way too, but with Orange Is the New Black and Enlightened, you see this unlikable woman who's entitled, full of herself, sort of narcissistic, and you're sort of turned off, and then. But, you know, you think about it, and wait a second, I watch all these shows with unlikable male protagonists, and I'm not turned off. And anyway, it's an interesting statement there, feminist-wise, I think.
Well, if that's enough for you, I had a hard time just with the premise, and maybe it was partly the unlikable character. And I just have to say, my vote's on House of Cards as the Netflix viewing selection of choice, but I'll let you finish your mini review.
Yeah, sure. That's fair enough. I liked House of Cards pretty well, too. So a couple things I liked. Just to say a little bit more about this unlikable female protagonist, more than just the political statement, I found it very interesting because this is a show that's sort of tailored to middle-class yuppie types, and she's the one representative of that at the same time. But at the same time, she's perhaps the meanest person there. She's one of the least sympathetic, but at the same time, I'm watching this and I'm relating to her, but also maybe thinking about how, you know, just because I relate to her doesn't mean that she's the best person there. I don't know. I found that really interesting.
Okay, you're slow. You're maybe slightly bringing me back, but It's one level higher in the queue.
the one other thing is just every layer, every episode, it just peels back one more layer about the other people there, the other women in the prison, and you finally get to know them, see what makes them tick, see what causes them pain in their lives, see the circumstances in which they committed their crimes, and you just feel, I don't know, you feel like you get to know them a lot. I just found it created a really rich world that I just like spending time in every week.
Well, cool. Sounds like a decent enough show. 4 out of 5, right? Oh.
Blue Jasmine was somewhat different for us. We just reviewed. And then this one, I think we like differently. I'm just putting this in the old data points about shows we have different tastes on. So this is interesting for me.
There you have it. I like it.
All right. Let's get to some weekend picks, Bob.
Yes. I'll go first. I'm excited. This is the weekend in August for me. Mostly driven by one movie. So back when we first started this rebirth of our podcast / vidcast, we did kind of like the top 5 movies to look for over the summer. And one of my original top 5 is coming out, Elysium. So this is done by the same director, writer-director who did District 9, which I loved. You can have minor issues with it if you'd like. Some people do, but I thought it was a brilliant film.
Interestingly, just that's one that didn't quite land for me, too, District 9.
Oh, really? Wow, this is a show of disparity here or something.
Yeah, but sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
So District 9 is a good barometer for what we might have in store for this show. We'll see, though, because this one's going a little more mainstream than District 9 did. It's got Matt Damon and Jodie Foster. The premise is again, an economic disparity one where you've got the 1% of the population that has all the resources living in a utopia of sorts, and then Matt Damon's lead character is trying to reach that utopia, and he lives in on Earth where life is kind of a slum world of sorts, and I think that's enough to set it up. I'm really looking forward to it. It's kind of one of these action-heavy, but hopefully better than just a summer popcorn movie, which is kind of how I characterize District 9. Pretty action-heavy, but had a little more to say and a little more substance than just a summer popcorn action comic book movie or whatever. So that's Elysium. One other movie that I have my eye on, but I'll probably have to watch it later because it's...
I have one movie that I wanted to get your take on. I wonder if this is it.
Okay. Is it Prince Avalanche?
No.
Okay. So this movie stars Paul Rudd, and I don't know much about it other than it's a quirky, offbeat comedy about two guys doing road work, and it's just dialogue-heavy, from what I understand, and one of these not much going on in terms of plot or story, but more about how these characters evolve with each other as they're doing road work. And it's kind of an indie dramedy sort of thing starring Paul Rudd. And I have a soft spot for Paul Rudd. I actually watch pretty much everything he's in. So I think he's a really likable guy, character. He kind of plays the same character a lot of times, but I'll let you know when I see it.
Cool. Well, I had one movie while we're on movies. I just saw the preview for this while I was watching The East, and the preview actually made me so I think I kind of want to watch it. It's In a World. With Lake Bell, who's also the director and the star.
Oh, so, I don't think I saw
it's
that
about
preview.
Movie voiceover people. but it looked funny, you know. It's got Fred Malamud, that's how you say it. Dimitri Martin. I don't know. The preview just got me. Movies are usually your domain. I just wondered if you'd seen that. You should check out the preview. See if you're interested in seeing it.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. In a World, Dimitri Martin's coming back. He's kind of this quirky Comedy Central comedian dude. I didn't know he was still doing things. That's cool.
Yeah. but the main weekend pick I have this week in the TV department is pretty obvious. One of the TV events of the year, Breaking Bad, is coming back on Sunday.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And this makes it why it's also the epic weekend of Bob, because I'm catching up on Breaking Bad to get ready for this, and it's an exciting show, and I have my exciting movie, but tell us more.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you don't know Breaking Bad now, well, I don't know what to say, but it's created by Vince Gilligan, starring Bryan Cranston, who cleans up at the Emmys every year. Breaking Bad is just a super critically acclaimed show about a high school chemistry teacher who gets cancer and turns to selling meth to take care of his family in this expensive time. The classic tagline that Vince Gilligan used to pitch it was, he wants to take Mr. Chips and turn him into Scarface, and this is going to be the final season, the final half of the final season, where the Scarface is pretty heavy. Not much Mr. Chips left, a lot of Scarface left.
Yep, yep. And to the show's credit, from what I've seen so far, I'm midway through season four. This transformation, I don't think it's been done on TV before, to take such a run-of-the-mill local regular guy and turn him into a bad guy, so to speak, over a lot of developments.
Yeah. It is, I think, pretty... Well, my TV knowledge doesn't go too far back, well, in terms of decades, but it's a real strong... unusual statement that they're pulling off really well. If you haven't watched it for some reason, which was you a few weeks ago, you should you should catch up on it, and it sounds like you're enjoying your catching up on it.
Definitely.
And, you know, so set your DVRs Sunday at 9, at least here in the East. I imagine it's 9 everywhere, but check your local listings, I guess. That is what you want to do this weekend, watch Breaking Bad Season 5, Episode 9, the second half. So awesome. There you go. Go forth and watch, people. It's TV. It's movies. It's practically culture. Okay, Bob. Let us do some of our TV recaps. Let's start with the newsroom. Now, Bob, you see on TV shows sometimes, right? When in like in a lawyer show, and you know you're. Mm-hmm. Imagine yourself in the position of a lawyer. You've got your witness on the stand. All of a sudden, your witness says something that completely hurts your case. If you're a TV lawyer, you say, well, first your jaw drops. You look at the judge and you say, permission to treat this witness as hostile, Your Honor. And then the judge hopefully grants it, and then you just change your whole approach. I feel like that is what I'm wanting to do with my newsroom recaps. Permission to treat the show as hostile, Your Honor. I
granted.
Feel like I hate reviewing this as much as anything. Thank you, Your Honor. So I didn't even really make what I liked column this time, and some of our listeners are probably happier with the show than I am. I'm hoping that maybe you can represent what you like about the show. I'll try, but I'm just going to get right into the stuff I don't like.
Let's do it. Tell me.
Okay. This storyline with Jim on the Romney campaign, I just, artistically, you know, entertainment-wise, and also, they're throwing in the sexism there, too, for me, just to give me everything to be pissed off about. I'm glad, one thing I'm really glad about is that they are messing up, they're suffering consequences for their principled stand, like they didn't get some advanced copy of something, so they all look like assholes to their news organizations, these people who are on this little protest with Jim. That was nice. There are consequences. Anyway, as we go on, blah, 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 boring, boring, boring to that, we have a little Mormon alert as Jim thinks he's so smart in a very Sorkin-esque way of pointing to some little hiccup in the he was a leader in the church in 1977, but blacks didn't get the priesthood until 1978. Whoa, stop the presses here.
This is in response to what's his name, the Texan guy having a ranch with an interesting name or something like that, right?
Oh, yeah, a name that they decided they were going to say on the newsroom, but I don't know if I'm brave enough to put it up on our, on our little cast here. Yeah, you know, race and different races, how you deal with that. That was a big theme this time. I'm not sure I really loved how the newsroom dealt with that, but we'll get to that shortly.
Right. Rick Perry.
Anyway.
Yeah, I couldn't remember his name, yeah.
Rick Perry, and also they went to Africa as the great white saviors to these poor African kids. anyway, but Jim finally gets the press secretary to tell him to go fuck himself. as though she'd never heard of this little thing, and it wasn't even framed in a very, very stark way, I didn't think. But maybe that's because I know a lot about the story, growing up Mormon, blah, blah, blah. So what does he do? He asks a favor. Oh, well, since I got you to blow up on the record, why don't you give this girl over here your 30-minute one-on-one with Romney? Now, why does he do this? Because he was in the car and heard this boss who maybe she's sleeping with, who even knows, but he was really rude to her, and he feels like, oh, I'm a man in an Aaron Sorkin show. What do I do when a woman is in distress? I need to rescue her, because she is going to like me rescuing her.
Yeah, and it gets worse, right? Because at first, she blows up for the attempted rescue and sees right through it and is like, you're just doing this because you're being stupid, and I can't believe you. And then later, she's like, just kidding, this is awesome, kiss me, I love you.
Yeah. It really like, turned me on when you stood up for me. Just that exactly what happens. Jim has seen the Aaron Sorkin shows before. He knows that's going to happen. So it works out for him. At least Mackenzie was pissed, as well she should have been, that he gave away the 30 minutes. And so I guess Jim's going to leave the Romney campaign. And I'm with Charlie when he's like, we would pay this guy way too much to be go doing that. And he's, I don't remember if Charlie said this, but implied was, and he's not doing a very good job anyway.
Yeah, I don't think he said that, but I think he should have. That would have made it better.
So that part really annoyed me. Why don't we get to... I don't mean to be in full-on rant mode, Bob. Do you have anything you want to interject here before I get to my next rant?
Oh, I think you nailed it with the way that played out. I just say that whole on-the-road subplot felt like a throwaway for me from the beginning anyway. It didn't feel like it was going to go anywhere. It felt like it was a time filler. Jim is supposed to be this endearing, likable character who's between women and can't get a break because he's always at the wrong place at the wrong time. Now he has some reporter chick who's infatuated with him because of a favor he did. Bleh. It's just, what's there to love about that? Let's move on to something where maybe I can have a difference of opinion.
Okay. So since we hinted at the race stuff, we had a lot of race stuff this time, right? We had Rick Perry's ranch, which apparently was big, and the newsroom showed us. What did the newsroom show us about the integrity of ACN, that they actually said the name of the ranch? That isn't something that polite people say. But I guess they have integrity. That was good of them to say it.
They have balls. I don't know. They're tough. They're gritty. It seems like it's like stepping in a landmine for stepping in a landmine reason.
Right. I don't see that they saved anyone's life or showed that they had... whatever. That's a newsroom. At the same time, Maggie is going to Africa with Gary Cooper. Of course, we have a black guy whose name is a joke. What we're realizing is they have a race issue as well as the sexism issue here. Anyway, so they go, and then while they're on their trip, they go visit this orphanage, and Maggie reads to this poor African kid a bunch of times, and I guess she feels an attachment to him. And the tension's building here, right? Because we see her in the beginning of this episode and the beginning of the whole season with her different hair, and Will says, in like the first episode, if what happened to her happened to you, you'd kill yourself for the rest of your life or something bizarrely Will like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we know what happens to reporters in foreign countries. Sexual assault, kidnapping, stuff like that. And so we're thinking, oh, crap, this could be really, really bad. Anyway, but we just see her develop this relationship with the kid, and then there are gunshots there. And so the kids try to evacuate the orphanage they're living in, but this one kid she likes, he doesn't make it, so they try to take him and save him. But in the escape, this kid gets shot and dies. And we also find out that the only reason the gunmen were attacking was because they were there with the camera in the first place, so she's coming to try to save these kids. Well, that's not what she's thinking in her mind. It just had those romantic tones of, oh, these poor African kids, if only they... Now they can know what the word blonde means because these people are here to enlighten them. But no, they get the kid killed just because they were there. And that's tragic. I feel like it was a little bit of a letdown and also sort of manipulatively sentimental. Just after the build-up, everything happened to Maggie, I was like, oh, that's it. She couldn't save the African kid that she fell in love with. Sad, but I don't know. Manipulative.
I feel the same way. I'm glad that there's not much difference in our two ways of approaching this. I mean, the kid was kind of riding piggyback as she was running out of the building, saving him. And so the other part of the story is that the bullet was meant for her, or at least he stopped the bullet from hitting her, and it went into his spine. And theoretically, this is a tragic story that would be high stakes and mean a lot, and you know, drive the newsroom into some new level of something. But I don't know. I didn't connect with it at all. It felt like, because of the whole line with Will early on and the flashback mentality that the show went for in the first episode, and by the way, the flashbacks are back, like, now it's like halfway through the season, it's like, oh, we're using flashbacks again, okay. Not effective. We already knew something extreme happened just by her hair color. It's just like such high stakes were set up, and then we see what happens, and it's too bad, but it's just the expose, the order of operations here was done poorly, and like I just didn't care as much as I should have.
Well put. I have another question for you, Bob. Did you feel like Will really mistreated that Occupy Wall Street chick who came on the show?
No more than what he normally does with a lot of his guests, where he's trying to, you know, be the most charming guy in the world with all of his knowledge. And he just felt like he was back to his old self, and maybe she was a newbie and inexperienced with being on TV. But I don't think he necessarily pulled out the big guns for her specifically. But he was kind of a dick, but like no more so than he usually is, I guess.
Yeah, well, we went back and forth, right? Because Neil, when she was pissed off, he's like, hey, you sort of tanked. He didn't do anything to you. You were not a very good representative. He wouldn't play unfairly. He was smug. And you know what? Will's definitely smug, but that's not a crime in the world of TV news.
Right. And I actually didn't think she tanked. Maybe this is some weird spin-off of the sexism thing, because she's pretty and she had some interesting points. So I watched her and I'm like, yeah, she did an okay job. You know, Will found all the holes in her arguments and went at them right away, but it's not like she was sweating or buckling under pressure. She held her own, even if she couldn't come back with a rebuttal on every single point that Will made. But she did okay for being first time on TV, for sure, anyway.
Yeah, all right. But then, if that were in its own little box, it'd be you know, live with a bull. But then, of course, she just happens to know some person for the Genoa story. And so then everyone needs to go and court her. And then because she is overreacting to how badly it went, she gets to hanging over everyone's head. They get Sloan there, who's also just as smug as Will. And then Don shows up, and she's like, oh, this is the best you can do. But they just have to try to be nice to her so they can get this Genoa tip. Oh, little brackets opening here. Did I miss something? What the hell is the red team?
Oh, they explained it toward the end. It's just a part of the newsroom that needs to be held in the dark so that when there's enough of this controversial story or any controversial story, that they have a fresh set of eyes to poke holes at it, different from the set of eyes that have been like knee-deep in it the whole time that they've been researching it.
Okay, I must have been typing something on my computer or something when they explained it. But a lot of they used it a lot before they explained it, right?
Yeah, they did. They used it a ton before they finally explained it, and I had to go back and be like, oh, I wish I would have known that like a long time ago.
Okay, well, if that was my sloppiness or laziness, I guess I can't kill him for that. But anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so then Will has to end up being the last resort to come court this Occupy Wall Street non-leader who's a leader, and we find out in the end that Will's just such a brilliantly nice guy, because it turns out that they figured out how to get the source that she had in a different way, and so he was just there in the end to just be a nice guy, and it was just so ham-fisted, and you know, he's like fourth in line, like this newsroom has nothing better to do than have all the senior producers and talking heads like chase down a source one by one. It's like there's no sense of efficiency or practicality here. And then in the end, it's like the guy who gets paid the most, he's just there to apologize because they figured out a different way, and everything we just saw was kind of a waste of time.
Well, we have to have a moment every episode where Will proves that he's the most wonderful man in the world, and I guess this was that. This was that scene.
It very much felt like that was the token. Will is the most wonderful man in the world.
So, yeah, I guess that's, for the most part, what I have to say about this newsroom episode. Anything else you wanted to add? Something on a cheerier note, if there is such a thing?
Oh, we didn't see very much of Sloane. She was smug, too, I guess, in that one scene. I don't know, Logan. I'm open to suggestions from people. This is going to be an open bracket meta thing, but hey, people, fans of the show, what are we missing here? Because we're sticking with it, but this is a step down from season one. It's like something's off, because season one used a lot of the same formulistic parts, but in the end, it all came together in a much better way for me. Somehow, I'm feeling like now I'm seeing too much of the behind the scenes of where all the cracks are. And if I rewatch season one, maybe it isn't as good as I remember it. But I don't think I'll do that. I'll just leave it as a happy memory.
Yeah, you should just come join me, get in Mystery Science Theater 3000, whatever that show's called, Mo. Just start making fun of it. Go hostile on the witness, Bob. I think, for me, I think it's helping. Watch this show.
Okay. Nice.
All right. Well, that's it, I think. The bridge, Bob. Let's talk about the bridge. So I have to say, the first thing I want to say about the bridge is I'm actually getting more and more into the question of just who this killer might be and whether we've met him yet. I'm not usually so focused on the plot in a mystery show like this, but this one I'm finally getting drawn in that way.
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit of that, but I'm purposely like holding back those thoughts because I hate the guessing game and then ultimately being wrong because there's a low probability. It seems like it could go any direction still.
Fair enough. But we did meet a couple new people, and so if we are meeting new people, then that means we may or may not have met the killer yet, I guess, right?
Right, that's true.
So we got this drug lord guy who we see at the very beginning, right? And he, I guess, is having a hard... So how'd they set it up? They kept saying there's extra attention on the border, so he's having a hard time smuggling it in, right?
Right.
So he has to go to this person who is harassing Charlotte to get that that tunnel opened up, and then he uses that tunnel and brings in a ton of money. We see him find Marco. I was a little confused about exactly what his... motive was it just to try to get this solved so the border would open? Why did he give all that money to Marco to help with the investigation?
Yeah, my understanding was $1 million or whatever the low stake was by comparison was like 1 week's worth of smuggling for this, you know, high up drug lord who's making tens of millions. Or so it was just kind of a necessary fee to pay to make this all go away or something like that.
Yeah, that's what he said. I guess for some reason I'm more suspicious. And I, like I say, I'm sort of enjoying this being suspicious, even though I can see your point. I'm usually more like you as far as not trying to guess too hard. But now I'm looking at this guy. I've got my eye on you, drug lord.
Yeah, I mean, he's a likely candidate. He's playing both sides. He could be, you know, asking for money and giving it, and it's definitely a possibility.
So the other new person we meet at the end, Linder's got this girl, this, you know, the girl who talks like this. I think his name's Linder, Stephen Linder. You know, he brings this girl to this. I guess it's like a religious ranch, and she's like, "What can I do for you?" "I'd like a kiss." And so she gives him a little kiss on the cheek / side of his mouth, and I guess that's what he wanted.
That was just weird and creepy because, well, so they're doing some intriguing expose there, because on the one hand, you think you already had reason to believe this guy was flaky and problematic and creepy, and then this episode spent a lot of time showing how he's actually true to his word. He said earlier in an earlier episode, like, he's just helping people, and this shows him helping this girl, but then his payoff is like, "I'd like a kiss," and you're like, never mind, he's still creepy. I don't know what the end result is of how to think of him, but he's kind of a mixed bag, I guess.
Yeah, sort of mysterious. And it seems like if you just do voice analysis, even though that's obviously not a very reliable way to go, it seems like it sort of sounds like him, the guy we hear, his voice garbled. But it's sort of leading us away from this guy as a reason to think of who the killer is.
Right, and then we have the guy that's running the ranch, but he's pretty short-lived as a character that we see. I don't know that we know much about him.
What, you mean the employee of Charlotte, or...
Oh, the
new character we met who runs this religious ranch. I got
you. Yeah.
But he's a new person. We don't know enough to know to exclude him or include him in the suspect list.
Right.
So in the main story, the feds are pretty much taking over this now that it's like this hostage case.
Yes, and there's one fed... Can you use that singularly? There's one Fed in particular who apparently has a lot of baggage and history with this, and we get a huge reveal on that front. But
how much to go through? That was finally a really interesting payoff that we got at the end, we just saw this video. So to connect the dots a little bit more here, so they're gonna do this drop. Yeah, and so then this drug lord's money comes in handy. They go to give the money, and he walks into the bar, and he's shown the message, and all of a sudden he goes rogue. He takes out his ear, and no one knows what happens to him. I imagine that he saw the video that everyone else saw at the end, right? And so he freaked out.
Right.
And what was it? I felt like we couldn't quite tell. We saw him drinking and a girl, but I couldn't quite tell if it was like he was abusing her or raping her or something like that, or if he was just having sex with her, or I couldn't quite tell what was going on. I hope it fills that in the next episode, but apparently it was something that freaked him out and was pretty damning.
Right, if anything, I mean, best case scenario for the guy is just on the side he's having sex with Mexican prostitutes, or I shouldn't jump to that conclusion. Maybe she's not a prostitute, but he's doing stuff as an FBI agent that he shouldn't be doing. But it seems like it's deeper than that. There's either abuse or something stronger. And obviously, the killer, the mastermind behind this whole plot, is pretty well informed with who is going to be assigned to which case. So there's a little bit of a coincidence factor here. But if the show pieces it together later, maybe it all makes sense, but the killer had to know that this FBI agent would be assigned to this case in this jurisdiction and blah, 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 and have it all come together so that he can make his point specifically for this guy who he would know would go rogue. So it's kind of getting a little bit into that too planned or coincidence-driven for me, for my likings in terms of a mastermind criminal just having everything work out for him, but you know, it's forgivable.
Yeah, he's almost like a Lex Luthor level superhero bad guy.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. What else do I have? Oh, Sonia. She figures out a way to narrow down where this girl is, and they actually go and find her. She's doing her Sherlock Holmes-ness, I guess.
Right. And again, this is another plot point where the criminal mastermind having somebody make a breakthrough, because Sonia says it like, he made a mistake. Check out the shadow here. He made a mistake. And now I can go figure out where it is. They go find the girl before she dies. And so part of me wants to know the alternate reality. Like, this criminal mastermind still got away with making his point with the girl being saved. So maybe the girl living or dying wasn't the point after all, or maybe... I don't know, maybe I'm overthinking how pre-planned this criminal mastermind does everything, but that sort of seems to be the point at the same time that it's not for certain things.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. If he's getting people killed, it seems to be guilty people killed. Well, I don't know, he killed all those migrants coming across the border too, so I don't quite have him figured out, but I actually kind of like where you're thinking with that.
Right.
That may be part of his plan instead of foiling his plan.
We'll see.
So yeah, that's about what I have on the bridge this episode. How about you, Bob?
Yeah, it was okay. I have to say, maybe it's because we're in the mid-season doldrums and things are a little more filler-like. I wanted a little bit more. We still don't know why the reporter, I forgot his name, is...
Fry,
why he's such a prominent character from this criminal mastermind point of view.
Dick?
Yeah, I mean, he's still a dick, and I guess we get it, you know. That's his personality, but why he's kind of the delivery mechanism for every piece of news. And by the way, why he, when getting information, he's still taking several minutes to, like, relay the information to the FBI or to the police. Like, he goes out and tries to do something on his own, like, for the third time, and it just feels a little too, for as much of a dick as he is as a low-level local newspaper reporter, you'd think he would just be cooperating more directly with the police at this stage of this huge crime investigation, but whatever.
Yeah, there could be more to that story. Good eye.
Yeah, we'll see. But I'm hopeful. The show's got me intrigued enough. We're still watching it, even if I guess this episode was neither here nor there. I want more, but I'm ready to see more later.
All right. Well, let's go to Ray Donovan, Bob.
All right.
So I'm actually going to say something here, and this is as much fun of a Ray Donovan episode as I can remember.
Oh,
What do we got? We got monkeys. We got Ray on the phone yelling at his client to stop right now, right as he's finishing with the prostitute or someone. We've got the cat and mouse game between Ray and the FBI agent. That's really heating up, and I'm liking that. We've got Mickey still making moves on Ray's family. We get to see Ray in action as a fixer. We get to see a little John Boyd dancing. There are more moments that made me smile to myself than I'm used to.
I love it. The glass is half full, looking on the positive side.
You know, and generally, for most of this episode, Ray is pretty much, you know, winning. Things are going his way, at least for the first 45 minutes.
Yes, until the epic scene at the end, which, if it wasn't over the top for the first 45 minutes, it's like over the top by the end.
Yeah, so we'll get to that. Let's cruise in here. So, like I say, I'm getting more and more invested in this cat and mouse game between Ray and this FBI agent. I just love the whole way that went. I loved seeing Avi appear at the diner with the coffee mirroring him and slipping him some LSD. But I thought that was smooth and almost Ocean's 11-y in the way they just pulled it off brilliantly.
Yeah.
They set him up, he drives slow, and Ray has a cop friend take him home and give him the sobriety test and, I guess, film it. He starts hallucinating about his toys. And then Ray shows up, and he's very intimidating, strong-arming him. And what I was thinking at that point was, this is actually the worst thing we've seen Ray do, strong-arming an FBI agent. We don't know what he's done in the past still that's worth doing something so illegal as strong-arming an FBI agent. And that, if there's one thing that I'm still really looking for, is I don't understand what Ray has done so bad in his past that all this stuff, like Ezra says, oh, we got to kill Mickey, they're really strong-arming this FBI agent. I don't know that, but I liked seeing him do it.
Fair enough. I have to say Avi is my favorite character in the show. He's kind of a lesser role, but anytime he's on screen, he's like badass, but with like a quiet humility. It's kind of nice, you know.
A dignity to his profession.
Yeah, exactly.
A real craftsman. Yeah, so let's see. I'm also starting to feel like I'm getting to know and even like the family more than I have in the past. This party, I felt like they had a few good moments there. I like seeing the dynamics of how they interact. They like cover for each other when Bunchy, he's on his bender and he's picking up Connor, Ray's kid, and Mickey, he sees them, and it could be a very tense situation because it is dangerous, but he doesn't want to embarrass Bunchy, and he sort of almost tenderly gets him to put Connor down. I don't know, that interaction told me a lot about how this family knows they're fucked up, but they sort of help each other and look out for each other with some affection almost.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, if at this stage, if you're still watching, you have to be bought into the premise that such a fucked up family at this level exists without them all being in straitjackets. They're like on the brink of being the worst family ever. But for being in that way, you know, they do have this
love for one another in a very unique way, given their circumstances.
Yeah, Mickey Trezor got a bunch of laid. I enjoyed that little scene with, I can't remember Ray's daughter's name, but him and Terry, they're just talking about their boyfriend and girlfriend who were dancing. I just thought that was just a nice scene. A lot of affection there, and finally seeing.
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to say that reminded me of this is Bunchy, when he's trying to get a blowjob, he ends up seeing a priest and has a really hard time. And back with the FBI agent, I guess these are independent themes, but the common theme here is when the FBI agent is on his LSD trip, he's seeing a monkey, he sees water on his desk, his action hero guys that he collects come to life and start playing games. I mean, there's like some animation in the show, there's some quirkiness. So like originally, last episode or a couple episodes ago, I had some issues with the way the show was dealing with visually showing things as characters perceived them when they were either crazy or high, and now the show is like full on committed to that way of storytelling. And I feel like now that it's more committed and we're seeing it from multiple characters, I can be more okay with it. It's still not my artistic, you know, preference of choice for how to explain plot points, but I see what they're going for, and it's kind of quirky in its own way. So,
all right. Okay. I feel like there were two big things at the end, but you pointed to one exactly. So one of them was, you know, Ray knows that Mickey's working with the FBI, and he shows up after the party really mad, and he ends up hitting pistol whipping his dad, Mickey, in front of his kids, and no one is very happy about that. That was a pretty big thing he did.
Yeah.
Is that what you were talking about?
That's what I was talking about. And it was more than pistol whipping. It was like pointing a gun at his face, and then after pistol whipping him, pointing it at his head, and there was like this real tension of like the show wanted you to believe that Ray could, in this moment, although you know that it wouldn't happen, could kill his father in front of his kids. Like, he had intentions to kill his father, one part of his brain or one part of his personality, and then he was just holding back. And he did it all in front of his kids, which, wow, if the fucked up factor wasn't already there, now it's, like, really there, and I don't know how this is going to get back to his wife exactly. And
oh, yeah.
I thought it was a bit much. I think the same point could have been made without such a long pause with the gun pointing at Mickey's face or at his head after he slapped him and his kids crying and all the other characters just waiting around Ray, like not wanting to intervene. It was just really weird. Even for Ray Donovan standards, it felt maybe one too many over the tops.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I felt like I was more on the side of the kids, like, wow, Ray, you are going too far. I mean, so what do we know? That Ray is really mad that Mickey is working with the FBI. I guess that, you know, makes him mad. But still, I keep going back to this. I don't know what Ray has done to be the target of an FBI investigation that he's going to go to jail for. If I knew that, then it would just help complete the picture for me to understand why the stakes are so high for Ray in his own mind of why he is willing to threaten his dad in front of his kids.
Right, and there is a sense of, like, Ray is being paternal and his kids are in danger, but we didn't see enough of that. Ray just jumps to that conclusion, again, based on some history, because otherwise, yes, there was a minor fire, and if anything, the show could have done better, like having Ray interact with his son, who ended up, you know, getting a beer that night, or there was some drugs going on. There was just a lot more going on, and it felt like we skipped over all of that. And the point was, Ray was pissed because of the past more than because of the present, which we really need to know the past if that's going to be how we're going to see things.
I agree. And then the other thing that happened after that was that Ezra finally having a lucid moment, just like, oh, well, so we have to kill Mickey then, huh? And then Ray just like, having gone through that. It's more complicated than that. He is my dad.
It's not that simple. Yeah, which is, again, like way too on the nose. I just tried that in front of my kids. I don't think it's going to work out that way. Like, thanks, Ray.
And so Ezra's like, well, who do we know that hates him more than we do? And then we see just some guy watching America's Funniest Home Videos, and I laughed that someone laughs at America's Funniest Home Videos, I guess. That was what was funny about that scene. People still like that show?
Right. So much.
But I guess that seems like some foreshadowing. Maybe they'll get someone else to come at Mickey.
Yeah, because being behind the scenes when it comes to a plot to murder someone, you know, is way, way better than just murdering them in front of your kids, which it is. But
yeah, I got to give them that one.
Anyway.
So, like I say, I felt like this had some good signs that I liked it more than I've liked the last few episodes, Bob. I hope it continues on this trajectory of just having a little bit more fun in there. Just to help the medicine go down.
Yeah, yeah, or just more to do with not just this immediate family. I like seeing characters like Avi or things going down where Ray's actually working. And by working, I mean it's not just dealing with his dad and his own family, because that theme is...
Yeah, it was
is...
fun to see him fixing.
Right, right.
I agree. All right, well... That's this week's episode of Practically Culture. Find us at practicallyculture.com. Catch our new YouTube channel where you can see video clips of this episode. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Logan Bow. Bob's at Bob Caswell. Leave us a comment. Send us a tweet. Let us know how you like the podcast. Get out there and watch some TV and movies, people. It's good for you. Thanks for rocking with us.
Have a good one.